one person goes up to a tree and sees a certain animal on a tree, and he gets excited because he sees this beautiful red animal, and he goes back to his friends and says, "Hey, there's this beautiful red animal on a tree. Go check it out." And then their friends, a few minutes later, they go up to the tree, and they see a green animal, but no red animal. They then come back and they start fighting with the friend. And then this happens several times, different people going to that same tree, but seeing the animal in different colors. And they start arguing with each other. And then finally, there's one person who lives under the tree, who sits under the tree at all times. And he says, "Oh, stop your fighting. I live under this tree. And let me tell you that you're all right in a way, but you're all wrong in limiting that animal to just the color that you think it has, because it's a chameleon." Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Fear Radical podcast. Today, I have the fortune and interest to meet with a sannyasi and scholar from the Ramakrishna Mission, Swami Medananda. Swami Medananda is a monk of the Ramakrishna Order and scholar of philosophy, currently serving as senior research fellow at the Vedanta Society of Southern California and Hindu chaplain at UCLA and USC. Specialist in Vedanta and global philosophy of religion. He edits for the International Journal of Hindu Studies and has written extensively on Sri Ramakrishna, Swami Vivekananda, and Sri Aurobindo. He joined the Ramakrishna Order in 2010 and took sannyas in 2020. He's the author or editor of several books, including Swami Vivekananda's Vedantic Cosmopolitanism, An Infinite Path to Infinite Reality, and has published over 30 academic articles. He holds a PhD from US Berkeley and is currently working on books with Oxford and Cambridge University Press. We have a very inspiring, edifying conversation with Swamiji, talking about the difference between Brahman, Bhagavan, personalism, and impersonalism, and the possibility of entertaining both in one's own tradition, whether his tradition, my tradition, other traditions. But also specifically, we studied and went to the details of the apparent hierarchy between Bhagavan and Brahman, or the apparent superiority portrayed by certain traditions, including ours, of the personalist realization over the impersonal, and his arguing in his articles and presentations about the equality of them from different perspectives. So if we've gone through that and revolving around concepts like radical non-dualism, radical personalism, varieties and shades of what both personalism and impersonalism in a very dynamic, interesting exchange. So this is a Free Radical podcast. And as you know, to support it, please subscribe by hitting the click, by clicking the bell, by sharing the episode with others. And if you feel nourished for the conversation, like it, share your thoughts so we can continue with this ongoing conversation. So without further ado, dear brothers and sisters, here is Swami Medananda. So, Swamiji Medananda, thank you so much for participating, accepting our invitation for the Free Radical podcast. Welcome.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. So, before delving into the main topics of our conversation today, a brief introduction about you, if possible. How old are you now, Maharaji?
44.
44, okay. I'm 44 as well. So, which day and which month, maybe?
Let's see. August 24th.
Oh, okay. That's my father's birthday. We are close.
Okay.
So, you accepted sannyas a few years ago, right?
2020, yeah.
2020, 5 years ago. So, which took you to such a call and such a commitment? I always like to ask that about fellow sannyasis that I met on the path.
Yeah, that's hard to explain. I always say the short answer is purva janma samskaras, some late mental impressions from past lives. The main thing is I just wasn't satisfied with the ordinary worldly ideals that were on offer. I was at one point, sort of to the beginning of graduate school at Berkeley, I was considering becoming an academic. And then I started seeing the lives of some of these world famous academics, and I wasn't particularly inspired. And this line came to mind again and again. Sri Aurobindo's, it's from Sri Aurobindo's Savitri. There's a line which goes, "All is too little that the world can give." And I felt that deeply. And I was reading scriptures like the Gita, and the bhakti stuff didn't resonate with me at the time. Now, of course, it does. But at the time, I was an agnostic, but I strongly felt that through renunciation of worldly attachments and desires, I can attain a kind of transcendent peace. And I do that by realizing my true nature as an eternal soul separate from the body-mind complex. So that idea really resonated with me.
So that called you first to monastic life in the form of being a brahmachari and then accepted the order of sannyas?
Yeah, exactly. In our order, the Ramakrishna order, it's a 9 to 10 year training process where you're a brahmachari. And after about 6 years, you're given brahmacharya diksha, and you're given a name with Chaitanya. So mine was Buddha Chaitanya. And I was given the Gayatri Mantra and the sacred thread. So we're all kind of, in our tradition, we don't believe in the hereditary caste system. So whatever your caste was, they don't ask, but you're elevated to the, or given the status of a Brahmin when you're when you receive brahmacharya initiation, diksha. And then 4 years later, I took sannyasa and was given the name Swami Medhananda. And of course, during sannyasa, you transcend all the castes. And you're given different mantras and things.
And the thread is taken out.
Exactly, yes. And there's a little shika that is also cut off and cast into the sacrificial fire.
You are a sacred outcast now. So I came to know first about you, I think, by watching a few clips that you did in this YouTube channel, Closer to Truth. That was an interesting introduction some years ago. And then by a few common friends that we have, especially Father Kashin, as you know.
Of course,
he had visited us a few weeks ago here. And also, I assume you know him as well. At least he knows you, Dr. Jeffrey Long.
Of course, we're good friends.
So also I'm good friends with him. And especially regarding the latter, I remember reading an article that he published in the Journal for Vaishnava Studies. And then he's speaking about impersonalism, personalism, Gaudiya Vaishnavism, Ramakrishna. He says at one point that I will argue that the current of Swami Vivekananda's thought that Swami Medhananda in particular emphasizes places Vivekananda's philosophy closer to that of Sri Chaitanya than one might otherwise suspect. So I read that line and was particularly interested in knowing your particular take in the context of Vivekananda philosophy. But I'd like you to ask you, of course, about Vivekananda's views and your views of him. But maybe first of all, a few thoughts on Sri Ramakrishna, who is Vivekananda's guru. And you correct me if I'm wrong, Swamiji, but Ramakrishna was steeped somehow in Gaudiya Vaishnava practice. He grew up in a Vaishnava family in rural Bengal, right? And I've heard, I think there is one direct disciple and chronicler of Ramakrishna, Mahendranath Gupta. At least according to Jeffrey Long, he always believed that Ramakrishna was fundamentally a Vaishnava. He received this original name of Gadadhar in childhood.
So, I don't know. I'm not sure exactly about M's conviction about Sri Ramakrishna as a Vaishnava. He does say, interestingly, that in the main book, Kathamrita, which is translated as the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, there's a long passage which is omitted from the English translation. So it's only available to those who know Bengali and maybe other Indian languages. I'm not sure about other translations. But in the original Bengali, there's a section where M speculates that Sri Ramakrishna was not a follower of Shankara. In Shankara's school, because Shankara's school dismissed this world as an illusion, whereas Sri Ramakrishna accepted the world as a real manifestation of Shakti. And so M concludes that he was more of a follower of Ramanuja than of Shankara. And so it seemed as if there are only these two options in M's mind. It's either Shankara or Ramanuja. And I actually respectfully disagree with M on this issue, because I have a feeling that he didn't actually formally study Ramanuja's philosophy in that way, because if he had, he would have known that Ramanuja does not accept the reality of Nirguna Brahman at all. He doesn't accept the reality of impersonal, attributeless, non-dual, pure consciousness, which is the ultimate, according to Shankara. Whereas Sri Ramakrishna fully accepts the reality of both Saguna Brahman and Nirguna Brahman, which means the personal God and the impersonal absolute. And so I think that's a very stark difference between Ramanuja and Sri Ramakrishna. And there are other ones as well, more subtle ones, but
And since you mentioned this point, I will say that one of the most noteworthy characteristics of the teaching of Sri Ramakrishna is his, we will call it radical pluralism, not only in theory, but in practice, literally, right? Mm-hmm. Because he practiced in succession, not all at once, a wide array of paths. And he claimed that all of them led to an experience of the divine, right? Including Christianity, Islam, forms of Hinduism, what we'll call Hinduism.
Absolutely. And I think that I would also add, I mean, especially in contemporary context, I think it's important to add that he was not only a radical religious pluralist, but I would argue that he was also a multiple religious belonger. I was speaking to Catherine Cornell from Boston College when I gave a talk at Harvard University last year. And she mentioned to me that the latest term now that she prefers is religious hybridity. And so I would argue that Sri Ramakrishna was a religiously hybrid figure who was Hindu but also Christian and Muslim in a really radical way.
And his doctrine was named Vijnana Vedanta, right?
Vijnana Vedanta, exactly. Vijnana Vedanta.
So I don't know if you will could share a few introductory words about what it entails.
Sure. So I think the best way to explain the main doctrines of Vijnana Vedanta would be to contrast them with the traditional schools of Vedanta.
Okay,
so Shankara's school of Advaita Vedanta held that the ultimate reality is only Nirguna Brahman. It's only impersonal, attributeless, non-dual, pure consciousness. And Shankara accorded a lower degree of reality to the personal God by distinguishing two ontological standpoints. And he would say that from the standpoint of the highest truth, the Paramarthika standpoint, the only truth is... Exactly. So from the Paramarthika standpoint, the only truth is non-dual pure consciousness. But from the empirical standpoint or the transactional standpoint, the Vyavaharika standpoint, we should accept the reality of the personal God, individual souls, this world of names and forms, and so on. Okay, so that's Shankara's traditional classical Advaitic view. On the other hand, Ramanuja's school of Vishishtadvaita Vedanta and Madhva's school of what's often called Dvaita Vedanta, but... I think more neutrally, we can refer to it as Madhva Vedanta. Both of these traditional schools of Vedanta are bhakti schools, and they both held that the ultimate reality is Vishnu Narayana. And they did not accept the reality at all of Nirguna Brahman, of the impersonal, attributeless, pure consciousness of Shankara. And so these schools were at a loggerhead. And then several centuries later comes the school Gaudiya Vaishnavism, based on Achinta Bheda Bheda Vedanta, and to some extent Madhva Vedanta, and Vallabha Shuddha Advaita Vedanta. And these schools conceive ultimate reality as the Supreme Lord Krishna. But instead of dismissing Nirguna Brahman as unreal or as non-existent, they consider Nirguna Brahman to be real, but a very minor peripheral aspect of Krishna himself. Okay, so now in this dialectical context, I think that Ramakrishna's Vijnana Vedanta takes another step forward from Gaudiya Vaishnavism and Shuddhadvaita Vedanta as follows. So here are the core doctrines of Vijnana Vedanta. Number one, what exactly is the nature of ultimate reality? Sri Ramakrishna agrees with Gaudiya Vaishnavism and with Vallabha Shuddha Advaita that the ultimate reality is both Nirguna and Saguna. It has an impersonal dimension and a personal dimension. But unlike these schools, he places these the impersonal and personal dimensions of the ultimate reality on an equal ontological footing, which means that they equally depend on each other for their existence, like fire and its power to burn. Ramakrishna would often say, one cannot think of fire without thinking of fire's power to burn. One cannot think of fire's power to burn without thinking of fire. Whereas in the case of Gaudiya Vaishnavism, there's what I would call an asymmetrical ontological dependence. Because Krishna does not depend for his existence on for its existence on Nirguna Brahman. But Nirguna Brahman, which is just the peripheral brilliance of Krishna himself, does depend fully for its existence on the Supreme Lord Krishna. And so that's the first doctrine. So Sri Ramakrishna has a very expansive conception of ultimate reality as personal and impersonal, with form, without form. The formless divine can also manifest in countless forms, like Krishna, Kali, Ganesha, Christ, and so on, and as incarnations, of course. And at the same time, God is infinite and illimitable. And so you can never limit God to just this and nothing more. You can never say that God can only be X, Y, or Z. But God always exceeds these any kinds of limitations that are imposed on him. And the second doctrine, what is the status of this world? Well, this world is not a dream. It's not an illusion, which is the view of Shankara's traditional Advaita Vedanta. But it's Ramakrishna considers the world to be a real manifestation of Shakti, of divine consciousness. And the third doctrine, I'll maybe mention two more doctrines. So the third doctrine is what we already talked about to some extent, which is his radical religious pluralism. So the idea here is that he says that, so again, it's useful to contrast it with the traditional schools of Vedanta. So each of the traditional schools of Vedanta places one yoga, one kind of spiritual practice above all the others, hierarchically, and claim that there's only a single yoga that leads directly to or leads to the highest fulfillment. Okay. And so for bhakti schools, obviously it's bhakti. For Shankara school, it's the path of knowledge, Jnana Yoga. And what Sri Ramakrishna says is all four of the yogas have equal salvific efficacy, which means they are equally effective in taking us to salvation or liberation. And that the difference among the yogas really has to do with, and which yoga we make as central, depends really more on our preference and our temperament, rather than in terms of one being inherently superior to the others. And then fourth and finally, I would add, there are many more doctrines. That's all mentioned in chapter one of my book, Infinite Paths to Infinite Reality. But I'll mention one final doctrine, which has to do with the final state of liberation. So according to bhakti schools, typically the state of liberation consists in dwelling in an eternal heaven with the personal God in the form that you love most. And you dwell there for an eternity, and you commune with God, you lovingly worship and serve that God in that eternal heaven, and you yourself are in a non-physical eternal body of Shuddha Sattva, it's called. And Ramakrishna will fully accept that devotional ideal of liberation, but at the same time, he'll say that there is an equally valuable state of liberation, which is completely different from that, which does not involve dwelling in any kind of eternal heaven, but is the Advaitic, the classical Advaitic ideal of simply resting in your true nature as non-dual pure consciousness. And so there's no coming and going, there's no going to a heaven. What Advaitins accept is that there's a kind of temporary heaven, but eventually everybody has to rest in their true nature as non-dual pure consciousness. And Ramakrishna says, by contrast, that there are eternal heavens for bhaktas, for liberated bhaktas who want that kind of ideal. But he also says for those who don't, should also can also just choose to rest in their true nature as non-dual pure consciousness. And the way he put it is that bhaktas don't want to become sugar, they want to eat sugar. And so he saw becoming sugar and eating sugar as equally valuable ideals and equally real. And by contrast, Gaudiya Vaishnavas, for instance, have a hierarchy of forms of salvation in heavens. And of course, for them, the highest form of salvation is dwelling in Goloka with Krishna.
Thank you, Swamiji. So, yeah, from what I can understand, Ramakrishna presents or ascribes equal, not only ontological, but soteriological value to whether personalist or impersonalistic practice, attainment in transcendence, and so on.
Correct.
So a few thoughts in that connection. As you properly said, in Gaudiya Vaishnavism, which is the tradition I practice, unlike other Vaishnava traditions, we acknowledge the existence of both the personal aspect of God and the impersonal aspect of God. Srimad Bhattan, you may know this verse, Vedanti Tattat Pavidas Tattam Jagyan Advayam Brahmeti Paramadmeti Bhagavan Iti Shabdyate, where realities describe us. Advaigyan Tattva, non-dual consciousness. Of course, for us, non-duality doesn't mean radical non-dualism, as I will call it, which is that of Shankar, mm-hmm. which everything at the end mm-hmm. becomes. It's a reductionistic, in my opinion, to just Brahman is the only possible outcome.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But non-duality in terms of everything is interconnected and existed revolving around a common center, which is non-dual, mm-hmm. and which expresses, as you say, as Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan. Everything is mm-hmm. in God. God is in everything. We can call it also panentheism. As the mm-hmm. Gita itself says, Yomam Pasyati Sarvatra Sarvam Chamai Bhakti. So, of course, by Vaishnavas, the concept of the Absolute as merely impersonal is dismissed, or I will say it's basically absurd. They will consider with strong words, as you know, our very language, I will say, disallows it to even to say that Brahman is inexpressible or unthinkable somehow is to say or think something about it. Probably know we have quotes from, I don't know, Katha Upanishad, which of course describe Brahman as Ashabdam, Asparsham, Arupam, or Brihadaranyaka Upanishad also describing Achakshusham, Ashrotram, not denying all sense elements and perception. But then we have Chandogya Upanishad describing Brahman as Sarva Karma, Sarva Kama, Sarva Ganda, Sarva Rasa. So, yeah. And for us, in fact, the very word Brahman, as you may know, coming from the root Brim, which means to grow or to expand also, somehow could be taken as a quality. So, again, we are not again Nirguna Brahman. We are just acknowledging that there's the Nirguna aspect, the attribute-less aspect, but also we can understand Brahman from a dynamic, quality-full side, so to say, right? So for us, when we say that, when we hear that the Absolute doesn't have form or senses or sight in any form, we are saying that he doesn't have, or he, she, it, they do not have in a material way, in a mundane way. No? But there are spiritual attributes, there are spiritual senses, as well as there is the Nirguna Nirvishesha aspect, as you mentioned. No? So for us, basically, just to balance what you just shared, the whole proposition of the Absolute as an independent Absolute, the Brahman, impersonal Brahman as an independent Absolute, without being counterbalanced with a personal Absolute, by some contradictions. But of course, we acknowledge the impersonal as an expression of the Absolute, which is non-dual in nature. So, and I think I disagree. I agree, sorry, with you much more than probably many other Gaudiya Vaishnavas may agree. So we'll go into that point of the conversation. I will emphasize the importance of insisting on the non-dual nature of the Absolute, because many times in the name of creating certain hierarchies, we end up dividing the Advaita Gyan, the non-dual Absolute. So that's basically a contradiction of terms. So I personally feel we need to emphasize more this aspect of non-duality. Even in my recent book, I made a whole chapter on non-dual thinking. And I recall some members of my community like raising their eyebrows, because for many in my community, the term non-dual indicates
It has bad connotations.
Brahman. So you're like, where are you going, Swami? Where are you going?
Now, what tradition of Gaudiya Vaishnavism do you belong to, if you don't mind my asking?
Again, sorry?
What tradition of Vaishnavism do you belong to?
So my initiatory lineage comes from Bhaktisiddhanta, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati, and so on and so forth. Will be the branches from the Gaudiya Math lineage, so to say. But again, as you may already realize, and will continue to realize, it's not that I necessarily, there's no one fixed way, of course, of thinking about everything in the lineage, and I have my particular views. So, and in particular, in our tradition, I will say, which I call it polymorphic monotheism. No, there's one God, many forms, Bahumurti.
That's a nice term for it. Thank you. I can use that. Polymorphic monotheism.
Somehow it's based from one line from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Bhagavad Purana, where Akura says, Bahumurti Ekamurtikam. Referring to the
Bahumurti Ekamurtikam. Very nice.
So many forms, but actually one non-dual Absolute. So,
absolutely.
So in our tradition, we have this polymorphic monotheism. But again, if we don't have a proper non-dual foundation, in the face of many aspects of the divine, we may end up becoming polytheistic, right? If we don't have enough non-dual foundation, we'll think, okay, Ram, Krishna, Chaitanya, Baraha, Matsya.
Right.
We end up worshipping different gods. So I am all for insisting on a foundation on non-dual reality. And on that foundation, I will say of non-duality, diversity can exist, sustained by the interconnectedness of everything. I don't know. It's so
That's a great way of putting it. Yeah, I think I agree with you fully, yeah. Mm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because again, in our tradition, we are all about relationships and loving relationships. But right. I will say that until and unless we have a common non-dual foundation that connects us all, in one sense, we have nothing in common to relate, basically, with one another. So for me, the realization of non-duality as a bedrock facilitates the diversity and the relationality. So anyhow, as you were mentioning, some other Vaishnava Sampradayas, like Ramanuja Sampradaya, probably especially Madhva Sampradaya, they are not so fond of acknowledging the aspect of Brahman, like Sayujya Mukti also, Nirvishesh, Nirvikar. And in the Gaudiya Sampradaya, there is an openness to that, and we acknowledge Brahma Sayuja as an eternal goal. Though I will say that in some parts of my tradition, there's this idea that those who attain Brahma Sayuja, eventually they fall from that.
Oh, okay.
Which I disagree with. And I think this our scriptures support the idea that that's one one type of mukti. So I'm, to be honest, Swamiji, one of the main tensions of having also you here is in conversation, I think this can be a good opportunity to harmonize in the sense that on one side, we have some Advaitins that propose Brahman is the only possible reality and everything else is Maya, basically. And then we have some Gaudiya Vaishnavas or some other Vaishnavas who may say Bhagavan is the only possible reality. And if you attain Brahman, you eventually fall. So I'm trying, I hope, and I know you agree with this, we are trying to show both of these realizations are possible in eternity.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Of course, again, I admit that in our tradition, we have some strong words from our Vaishnava teachers to our Advaita Vedanta. I will argue an important point that I'd like to share with you. I will argue that those strong words are coming mostly from those who think that Brahman is only real and that our Krishna, so to say, is an illusion. That our loving interaction with God is false, that bhakti is only stepping stone to jnana at best. So from in relationship to that type of vision, our Vaishnavacharyas have taken a strong view. Not so much to pursue an Advaitic realization, but acknowledging there is also the possibility of a personalistic realization, so to say. So at least for me, this is my view, but for me, the idea of okay, only Brahman is real, everything else is false, could sound as fundamentalist, as exclusivistic, and as narrow-minded as saying you can only get salvation through the Gaudiya Sampradaya and through worshiping my Krishna, through my lineage. And I will say that from that place, some of our teachers have taken some
strong stand. Path.
We don't deny the possibility of Brahma Sayuja, though that may not be our cup of tea, so to say. As long as those who pursue it do not label every other path and goal as illusory, basically. And from that, we make a difference in opinion, in terminology. Sometimes we refer to those who approach, who consider Brahman the only possible reality as Maya body. And that's used in some kind of derogatory term. But the other expression used is Brahma body, which is for those who approach Brahman and also respect other possibility of tradition. So
The only I think that's kind of misleading Brahmavadi because every school of Vedanta accepts Brahman.
Yeah.
And they just define Brahman differently. Ramanuja and Madhva accept Brahman just as much, but they define Brahman as Vishnu. So that gets complicated.
I think
Mayavadi need not be necessarily pejorative. It just because of course post Shankara Advaitins use the term Maya all the time to refer to the world as an illusion. So
That I'm just saying how in my particular tradition these two terms are being used, right?
Right, absolutely.
I don't say that Mayavadi in itself is a bad term, but the tone we generally put in that word goes in one direction. And I also agree that Brahmavadi could be used in so many other terms, but that's how it's being used in this context. So anyhow, having said that, as you also mentioned in your definition of Vigyan Vedanta, in Gaudiya Vaishnavism there is some hierarchical distinction between Brahman and Bhagavan. So now we come to the point of your article. right? Harmonizing the personal God with the impersonal Brahman. Sri Ramakrishna's Vijnana Vedanta in Dialogue with Gaudiya Vaishnavism, which was part of an edited volume called Vaishnav Concepts of God, right? So basically, if I recall properly, in that article, you start appreciating how, unlike other Vaishnava Sampradayas, Gaudiya Vaishnavism accept the reality of Brahman as well as Bhagavan, yet you make the case that still Gaudiya Vaishnavism relegates Brahman to a, so to say, partial expression of Bhagavan, probably, while Ramakrishna doesn't hold that stance, or but embraces them equally and thus presents a broader harmonization. I don't know if I'm so far representing properly.
Yeah, it's a broader and I think less hierarchical harmonization.
As you mentioned, you use this term like asymmetrical ontological dependence versus mutual ontological dependence, right? So something I like to share with you, and let me know your thoughts about it, because when I read your article, I read it in New Zealand a few months ago, I was with Father Cash, and he recommended that to me, and I really appreciated it, and it churned, it was thought-provoking, unfortunately, I was not feeling like he's attacking my tradition, let's see how we can refute him in debate, that's not generally my mood, and that didn't happen, fortunately, it was thought-provoking. So I'm thankful for that to begin with. My thinking in this connection is that in a Gaudiya Vaishnava perspective, when we say Brahman is partial to Bhagavan, or Brahman is the halo of Bhagavan, or Brahman is dependent of Bhagavan, whatever hierarchical definition we will give, is particularly from a particular type of experience, so to say, through like the experience through which Gaudiya Vaishnavas generally filter and measure reality, which is love, basically, bhakti, or more specifically, I will use the term rasa. You are familiar with the term rasa. So as our distinction between these two faces of the same non-dual absolute, no, are based on this consideration of rasa. So that's kind of the Gaudiya Vaishnavism yardstick to experience the ultimate reality. So I will say that from a, we have these two ideas of tattva vichar and rasa vichar. So tattva vichar will be a consideration of reality from the standpoint of tattva, of siddhanta, of metaphysical truth. And from that perspective, we will say Brahman Paramatman Bhagavan, Brahmeti Paramatmeti Bhagavan, they are advaigyan tattva. They are one indivisible, similar truth. And we couldn't make like separation, hierarchy. Now, when it comes to rasa vichar or to the consideration in, on the basis of the potential for loving experience, that's when we make this particular point. For example,
that's that's a really. But can I just ask a clarificatory question then?
Yeah, please, please.
In Gaudiya Vaishnavism, doesn't tattva vichara derive from rasa vichara? I mean, can we really separate them neatly in that way? I mean, isn't it based on the spiritual experiences of these great Gaudiya Vaishnava saints that they've arrived at this metaphysical structure / hierarchy? Or do you not think that can we really separate these two in that way?
I will say there is a place for separate. I will say the opposite. We in our tradition will say first there is tattva, and on the basis of tattva comes rasa.
No, I guess, but what I mean is, how can you speculate about tattva without having realized tattva? So the idea is you need the spiritual experience of the truth and reality in order to then philosophize about it, surely. That's the idea. So that it seems to me that what you're suggesting is that bliss of the rasa of bhakti toward Krishna and love for Krishna is so great and so overwhelming that one then ends up subordinating Brahman to Krishna. Is that accurate? Or
what I will say is the following: for those in the Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition or in the bhakti tradition, the ultimate pursuit is again love, bhakti, rasa, however we may like to call it. So from that standpoint, the realization of Bhagavan is higher, so to say, in terms of facilitating a loving experience, while the realization of Brahman or the facet of the non-dual absolute as Brahman is lower, and again, I'm using quotation marks here, in terms that it doesn't afford that possibility, but it's not lower on an absolute sense, just from the perspective of one's particular pursuit. Like if you tell me, okay, but I'm pursuing the we could make this argument in the other direction for Brahman, I would say. If you pursue the non-differentiatedness of the absolute, then Brahman will be higher than Bhagavan.
Right, but I don't think that... So I mean, that sense, in my research, I don't find Gaudiya Vaishnava saying that, I guess. I mean, like Vishwanatha, for instance, in his commentary on that verse, the one that you mentioned, right, 1.2.11.
He
makes very strong claims about how the bliss of realizing Krishna and dwelling with Krishna is infinitely greater than the paltry, loveless happiness
that you find.
Right. So I do wonder, what do you think about that? I mean, doesn't there seem to be also a suggestion of a strong difference in terms of value?
But for me, that particular commentary, as well as many other commentaries, will go in the similar direction, because, I mean, you just pick one, but there are many of them.
Right, of course, right.
But all of them happen in a particular bigger context or picture or perimeter, which for me is rasa. I mean, for example, just a point that I want to make is, in our tradition, which is Gaudiya Vaishnavism, one of the main books is Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu by Rupa Goswami.
Sure.
So he's kind of the architect of the whole Sampradaya. Yeah, right. So he writes that work based on the Natya Shastra of Bharat in terms of aesthetics. So he develops a whole theology based on the notion of rasa, starting from the rasa vaisaha, asamhiyavayam ladbhanandi bhavati from Taittiriya Upanishad, and then describing Krishna's akila rasamrita murti. So he's establishing kind of this universal yardstick for the Gaudiya Sampradaya, which, or lenses, which is rasa. And it's interesting, because this is not even between Bhagavan and Brahman, but if you pay attention, you will see, like, okay, we will make even a distinction between Krishna and other forms of Bhagavan.
Right, yeah.
We will make a distinction between different forms of Krishna, Krishna Dwarka, Krishna Mathura, and Krishna Vrindavan.
So, right.
So we can make a case for a hyper-hierarchical tradition.
Right, there's a hierarchy piled upon other hierarchies.
Yeah, and even in terms of Krishna in Vrindavan, we can make a hierarchy in terms of the rasas, Shanta, Dasya, Sakya, Vatsalya, Madhurya. So all that is based on a rasa consideration and ultimately an experience of intimacy and sweetness. And that's the thermometer of the yardstick for all, in my opinion, of course, for all those kind of expressions that otherwise may sound utterly sectarian, fundamentalist, narrow-minded.
So can I ask you, that's helpful, and I haven't come across that distinction between tattva-vichara and rasa-vichara before, but when I see Gaudiya Vaishnava philosophers, theologians, making claims about asymmetrical ontological dependence of Brahman on Krishna, that seems to fall more under tattva-vichara than under rasa-vichara. So what's your take on that? Go ahead.
Again, I will go back to Badanti tattva vidas, and it's very important for me. That verse is very important, as you may know. Jiva Goswami, who is the main theologian of our whole Sampradaya, he wrote this Shatkandarbha. And there's this huge, monumental six-volume treatise, and the whole book revolves around this verse of the Bhagavatam, which defines reality as non-dual consciousness. So, so I will say that I agree, Swamiji, that currently I don't think or see or feel that many Gaudiya Vaishnava representatives emphasize this non-dual side enough, or these things that we are talking now. But personally, I see that, okay, if I go to the Sandarbhas of Jiva Goswami, our main theological treatise, here, the whole work revolves around this verse at the bottom, which defines reality as non-dual consciousness.
Okay, so, but here's the question then. Because I mentioned this in my article as well. When I discuss that verse, I quote Vishwanatha's commentary on the verse, which is very explicitly hierarchical again. And he's pointing out that there are different levels of adhikari, and that the lowest are followers of the path of knowledge, Shankara's followers. Then one step up is yogis. Who worship the Paramatma, which has just a few dharmas, a few qualities of Krishna. And then the bhakta is the superior, it's the most superior of all the spiritual aspirants. And so, because they worship Krishna, who has infinite auspicious qualities. And so I guess my question to you is, because it seems like you're referring to that verse, it's almost ironically, I mean, possibly, but maybe just clarify what I'm doing in my article is arguing that Ramakrishna's interpretation of that verse, from the standpoint of Vijnanavedanta, is a better way to interpret the verse than the more hierarchical Gaudiya Vaishnava way. But are you suggesting that there are other interpretations within the Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition of that particular verse that are less hierarchical or non-hierarchical?
Yeah, yeah, I will do so. Okay. And I will insist that interpretations like the one of Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur in particular, and his whole commentary, Sararta Darshini of the Srimad Bhagavatam in general, is very much rasa laden, very much like with the mood and the bhava and the lens of rasa. So, I mean, I'm not saying there's no tattva vicharas I was speaking, but it's very much rasa vichara. So you will find so many of his commentaries. Again, seeing outside of that context, it may sound this person is a fanatic.
Right. Okay. So I know that you find this, the first mention of Brahman in the sense of non-dual, impersonal Brahman as the Tanubha of Krishna in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, right? Tadapyasya Tanubha. And then presumably both Rupa Goswami and Jiva Goswami pick up on that and develop that. Am I correct in thinking that? So that presumably would fall under Tattva Vichara, right? I mean, exactly how does Brahman relate to the Supreme Lord Krishna? And so on my understanding of Gaudiya Vaishnavism, the relation between Brahman and Krishna is one of asymmetrical ontological dependence, just from the standpoint of tattva, that, you know, it's like I can live without my pinky toe, for instance. The pinky toe can be amputated and I can still go on living, presuming as long as it's repaired or whatever, but not the other way around, right? And so are you claiming that that's not the case with Jiva Goswami, for instance, or what? I just want a better understanding of your understanding of the sense in which Gaudiya Vaishnavas take Brahman to be the Tanubha or Pratibha, the peripheral brilliance of Krishna. Is that also from the standpoint of Rasa Vichara, or does that also fall under Tattva Vichara?
Yeah, I will personally insist on this point that all these claims that come from our tradition insisting of the ontological dependence of Brahman upon Bhagavan is from the point of view of what the relationship with Bhagavan affords in terms of bhakti rasa, which is what our tradition revolves around. It's all considering that first. So our tradition is about bhakti rasa, loving relationship. In terms of facilitating that experience, Bhagavan is higher. Again, using words like higher, they are words.
Right.
But as you know, our tradition is achintya, bed, abed. So we entertain both bed and abed on an equal level. And sometimes I argue jokingly in our tradition, sometimes we end up using too much of bheda and we forget the abheda, the non-differentiated. Yeah. And sometimes we end up practicing achintya bheda tattva.
we have to
add the achintya bheda abheda tattva. And again, all these rasa considerations, and as I told you, even with Krishna, different hierarchies with Krishna, in Vrindavan, different hierarchies of rasa, and Madhurya, ultimately, the sweetness of intimate romantic love. But as I like to say, right, Madhurya rasa is the sweetest possibility of relating to God, in our opinion, in terms of bhakti and loving relationship. That said, the sweetest experience may not be what everyone chooses. Not everyone likes sweetest thing. No, like I can say, objectively speaking, mango is the sweetest fruit on earth or whatever. Right. And someone may say, but I like apple the most. Okay, we can objectively say this is the sweetest, but this is not my favorite of the highest for me personally, right? So I would say our tradition emphasizes a particular type of, following the analogy, sweet juice or rasa, which is juice, and the element of madhurya, sweetness, but not everyone will experience that as their favorite fruit. As you say, Ramakrishna will say, bhaktas love to eat sugar, but some others may love to become sugar. As we consider Bhagavan in terms of rasa, I can understand how come someone make a similar claim, as I said, considering Brahman higher in terms of
the other way around,
an experience of non-differentiatedness or whatever. No? Something that I'm also thinking is that in our Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition, at least how I interpret Shastra and others, although there are some difference of opinion, to be honest, in our tradition regarding this point, which is whether bhakti is inherent or not in the jiva. So my opinion, and I have written my first book on that, is that bhakti is not inherent in the jiva, but received by grace. So we receive bhakti samskar. So the point I'm making this is that for me, that lays also a very non-sectarian foundation, because if we embrace that idea, we are not saying that everyone is eternally predestined to end up serving Krishna or to end up serving another form of God, but according to one's samskars, this previous life, we may end up in different regions, so to say, of the absolute. Brahman being one of those options. I always tell members of my tradition who are a little bit anti-Brahman or anti-Abhed, I say, well, but according to our tradition, you can attain that realization for eternity. So if that's possible for eternity, how can that be something bad? No. How can something have a place in eternity and be something right. not only bad, but why the need to create these hierarchies.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, I was at a conference just a few weeks ago in Rishikesh. It was a 3-day conference, if I recall correctly, on God and consciousness in Indian theistic traditions. And Ricardo Silvestre and Alan Herbert, both of whom I think belong to ISKCON, they organized a conference along with Benedict Paul Gurkha. And I met a wonderful young ISKCON Swami there. I forgot his name, unfortunately, it escapes me. But anyway,
from which part?
He had read my article. No, from India. He's based in India.
Okay.
And kind of scholarly Swami who's doing his PhD now in philosophy. We had a lot of great conversations, and he's very liberal. And he read my article and was a bit embarrassed by Prabhupada's remarks that I quote at the end of my article. And he kind of said that they were private conversations that should not have been publicized, basically, is what he said. But and that his own views are much less sectarian and dismissive of non-Gaudiya Vaishnava traditions. But I get the sense that even, I mean, you belong to a Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition separate from ISKCON, as far as I'm aware.
Yeah.
But what I'm noticing is that there's a diversity of views even within the ISKCON fold.
Oh, yeah.
And it runs the whole range, I mean, on the spectrum from very, maybe arguably fundamentalist and sectarian to much broader and more liberal.
Oh, yeah. You have the whole spectrum there.
Right. Yeah,
because ISKCON is such a big organization that you will find very different.
You'll find out
when people sometimes tells me ISKCON this or ISKCON that, but you cannot boil
you
down the one monolithic thing, but it's full of variety.
Yeah.
So out of curiosity, Swamiji, in connection somehow to what we are talking, how old you? I'm hearing in my mind the Purva Paksha coming from my own tradition toward me now. And they will refer, for example, to some sections from the Gita, which I assume is maybe also an important text according to you, at least it's according to us, so which seem to be indicating the superiority of the personal realization. Like, for example, Krishna and Deva. And I'm curious or interested in knowing how you will interpret or give us another perspective of that to create the type of balance that we are talking about now. Like, for example, I don't know, at the end of the 6th chapter, Krishna is saying, Yogi Nama Pisharvasham, and he ends up saying, Yuktatama Mataha, speaking about he who worships me with faith and love as the highest of all yogis. In second verse of the 12th chapter of the Gita, he says basically the same, Mayabes, Yamayo, Yamam, both and Yuktatama Mataha. So how will you explain verses like that to imply, okay, maybe it's not us being hierarchical, maybe it's Krishna himself being hierarchical, or there's another way of reading it through a more also Advaitic lenses or more Ramakrishna lenses?
I think that's a great question. I mean, I would say a few things. Of course, to really get into the weeds, we'd have to have the text in front of us and we'd have to look at the Gita as a whole, but there are a few things. You know, I'm teaching a class now called Bhagavad Gita in the Light of Sri Ramakrishna, and our own tradition doesn't yet have a commentary on the Gita from the standpoint of Ramakrishna. And so I'd like to do that at some point, maybe write an entire book. One on the Upanishads, one on Gita, one on Brahma Sutra. But yeah, let's see, God willing. But in the meantime, what I'm using as my main textbook is Sri Aurobindo's Essays on the Gita.
Okay.
Sri Aurobindo was strongly influenced by Ramakrishna and by Vivekananda. And so I'm writing a book now on Sri Aurobindo that's under contract with Oxford University Press. And yeah, so the main argument there is that all three of these figures belong to the same school of what I call integral Advaita. They're defending a non-dual philosophy that is all-encompassing, that doesn't say Brahma Satyam Jagat Mithya, but Brahma Shakti Satyam Jagat Satyam. Mm-hmm. And Sri Aurobindo, in his commentary on the Gita, he strongly emphasizes chapter 15 of the Gita.
Okay, Purushottama. And this,
yeah, the concept of the Purushottama. And he interprets the Purushottama there as the impersonal personal supreme reality or divine reality. Mm. So I see that as more or less identical with Ramakrishna's concept of Brahman and Shakti being inseparable. Mm-hmm. And so not placing the personal on a higher footing than the impersonal. And so he reads the entire Gita through the lens of that Purushottama concept in chapter 15. And so whenever he comes across verses that refer to where Krishna says, you know, you have to worship me, you have to come to me, the me there, he takes to mean the Purushottama.
Mm-hmm.
And not the Krishna of Vrindavana in that narrower sense, mm-hmm. but the broader impersonal personal Purushottama. And he'll emphasize verses like in chapter 4, which Swami Vivekananda also emphasizes, Ye tha mam prapadyante tam sataiva bhajamiham. So as people approach me, so I manifest myself to them.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of idea, that one and the same Purushottama in the sense of polymorphic monotheism manifests to different aspirants in different forms. And so that same Purushottama will manifest to Gaudiya Vaishnavas as the Krishna of Vrindavana. But he'll manifest as Kali to Shaktas, and mm-hmm. will manifest as Christ or as Mary to Christians, and as Allah to Muslims and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And without the hierarchies. And so I think there's a, and I'm not saying that's a right one, but that's the kind of interpretation of the Gita that I find plausible and that accords quite well with our tradition, which is broader, I would say.
Mm. Mm. Thank you. Mm-hmm. I have here a quote from one of your books, Infinite Paths to Infinite Reality. If you allow me, I will read a few lines mm-hmm. and ask you for mm-hmm. your thoughts. In this direction mm-hmm. also says, all religions are salvifically effective since all of them make contact with the real aspect of God, though none of them encompasses the whole of God, who is mm-hmm. infinite and illimitable.
Mm-hmm.
If you could expand it a little sure. bit, which of course I really appreciate those words.
Sure. So Ramakrishna will use, there's a parable he used to illustrate this point. He says, imagine an ant which goes to a giant hill of sugar. And with great difficulty takes one grain of that sugar
mm-hmm.
and then carries it with him back to his house. And then he starts bragging to his friends. He says, you know, this time I took just that one grain, but next time I go, I'll take that whole hill of sugar with me. It kind of puffed up with pride. And Ramakrishna says, that's foolish. We can never exhaust God's nature. We can never have an exhaustive knowledge of God's nature, because by definition, God is infinite and illimitable.
Mm-hmm.
You can never say that God is just this and nothing more. And so every knowledge of God is going to fall short inevitably.
Mm-hmm.
So that's Ramakrishna's realization on the basis of his own varied spiritual experiences. And so he'll sometimes use the famous metaphor of the blind man and the elephant,
yeah.
right? Different blind men are touching different parts of the elephant. But there's one person who adjudicates the fighting among these blind men. It's the person with vision who can see the elephant as a whole.
Mm.
And on my interpretation, that person who can see the whole elephant is the Vigyani.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, we have to correct or kind of balance that parable of the blind man and the elephant with his story about the ant. So he's not claiming that the Vigyani has a complete or total knowledge of God either. But he has a more expansive knowledge mm-hmm. of the divine mm-hmm. than even many other realized souls, many other mystics who have realized only one aspect or form of the ultimate.
Mm-hmm.
The Vigyani has a broader knowledge, but not a complete knowledge of the divine. That's the idea.
Mm. And since we are mentioning different analogies, if you can share with us the analogy that you shared in your article on the multicolored species, I won't spoil the
right
whole story by saying which is that one, because it's very, I really found it very interesting also.
Right. Yeah, this is a kind of less, you know, the blind man and the elephant parable goes all the way back to arguably Buddhism and then Jainism. So that's not unique to Ramakrishna, but he uses a different parable. And it goes roughly as follows. He says that one person goes up to a tree and sees a certain animal on a tree. And he gets excited because he sees this beautiful red animal. And he goes back to his friends and says, hey, there's this beautiful red animal on a tree. Go check it out. And then their friends, a few minutes later, they go up to the tree. And they see a green animal, but no red animal. Then they come back and just start fighting with the friend. And then this happens several times, different people going to that same tree, but seeing the animal in different colors. And they start arguing with each other. And then finally, there's one person who lives under the tree, who sits under the tree at all times. And he says, oh, stop your fighting. I live under this tree. And let me tell you that you're all right in a way, but you're all wrong in limiting that animal to just the color that you think it has, because it's a chameleon. And a chameleon, of course, can assume different colors, and sometimes it has no color at all. It can be colorless. And that's just the nature of the chameleon. And so you should stop your fighting. That's the idea. And so Ramakrishna says, likewise, the infinite, impersonal, personal divine has an impersonal static dimension, which is non-dual Brahman. That's the colorless chameleon. But each of the different colors of the chameleon corresponds also to different forms of the personal dimension of the same infinite divine. So it could be Ganesha, Hanuman, Krishna, Kali, Christ, Allah, and so on. Allah is formless but personal, but in any case, so it encompasses all of that. And again, it's structurally, this is similar to the blind man and the elephant, because there's one unique person. Right, which corresponds to the Vigyani, that person who has a more expansive knowledge of that absolute, of that infinite divine reality. So like the person who can see the whole elephant, but of course, as I said, with the caveat that he doesn't see the totality of God. Likewise, there's a person who has experienced the divine in multiple forms and aspects. And so on the basis of his own spiritual experience, he can adjudicate these debates and infighting among, you know, different realized souls saying, no, God is only impersonal, and some say, no, God is personal, but he's Ganesha. Another one will say, no, it's Hanuman, no, it's Christ. And the Vigyani can say, all of the above is true, but don't limit God to just that form of God that you've realized or experienced.
Yeah, it's such a temptation to limit the unlimited to our particular perspective of taste. And in one sense, it could be the ultimate expression of arrogance also, interestingly.
Yeah, and then, you know, Swami Vivekananda made an important, I think, observation about human nature in a way, but it's specific also to most spiritual aspirants. He says that when a spiritual aspirant has a lot of depth in his or her practice, that often translates into a narrowness. And that it's almost a trade-off between intensity of practice and depth of practice on the one hand and breadth of vision. Yeah. And then on the other hand, you get these people who are extremely broad, but maybe not so deep. Yeah. And you can argue that they're kind of spiritual dilettantes. They're a little superficial. But so the sweet spot is, can you combine maximal depth with maximal breadth? And that's the tradition as I see it that I belong to, but I try. I mean,
amen, Swamiji. I subscribe to that one. Totally. I myself love to use those two terms, actually, breadth and depth, and we don't want one at the cost of the other, basically.
At the expense of the other, exactly. It shouldn't be a trade-off. But it usually is, unfortunately, but that's
Which, again, is another way of being non-dual and embracing the two of them at the same time and not seeing black and white, okay, which one of the two can I choose, but embracing the two of them as nourishing each other. So you have this particular view, which I really appreciate, and the embrace of both personal, impersonal, in one non-dual reality. At the same time, in my short experience by knowing the Ramakrishna Mission, I become somewhat familiar with the thinking of other teachers of the Ramakrishna Mission, or maybe most of them think like that, which in my, according to what I saw, not only lean toward Advaita Vedanta, but some of them actually believe and maybe teach that ultimately there's only Brahman also. I'm not sure if I'm misrepresenting some of the current thinking in the Ramakrishna Mission at large. And maybe they believe that was Vivekananda and Ramakrishna's ultimate view, which in that case will seem to contradict a little bit with the views you are presenting. So I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, or again, if I'm mistaken, please correct me.
Sure, yeah. So here's how I see it.
our order has not yet come out and said, here is our official orthodoxy or our official philosophy or theology. Mm-hmm. Okay. Maybe they will in the future, Bilumat, but they haven't yet. Okay. The advantage of not having an official orthodoxy is that monks within the order, within the tradition, even different lay followers of the tradition, are free to think of Sri Ramakrishna and interpret Sri Ramakrishna and the views of Swami Vivekananda as they see fit. Yeah. Okay. And so I'm actually grateful to my order for giving me freedom to defend interpretations that are controversial. Now, okay, there are a couple things here. So, one thing is that it's difficult to generalize about the views of most of the monks in our order because the vast majority of the monks in our order are not public figures. Okay, they quietly sit in their room. They're not publishing articles and they're not on YouTube giving lectures, right? There are a tiny handful of monks in our order who are publicly prominent. Mm-hmm. So one of the, by far the most prominent, is Swami Sarvapiyanji, who's a good friend of mine and who was one of my acharyas, one of my teachers in training center for 2 years in Bilumat. And so, for instance, just use him as an example because he's so prominent. We can say, so he definitely primarily teaches Advaita Vedanta. I don't think it's exactly congruous with Shankara's Advaita Vedanta, in fact. And in fact, I also see his views as evolving to a certain extent, mm-hmm. and that if you compare his lectures on Advaita Vedanta now in 2025 and compare them with his earlier lectures back in, you know, 2019 or something, there are going to be some differences. And he's this is my own take on what doing, but I do see that he's moving in more of a Vijnana Vedanta direction, in part because of my work, I think, and then there are other factors as well. And so he's willing to grant greater prominence to bhakti as a path as well. And he's not so quick to say that the personal God is a lower reality or a lower truth, things like that. But yeah, it's certainly the case that he does tend to teach some form of classical Advaita Vedanta or something close to that. Mm-hmm. But as I said, he's not representative. Nobody's representative of the order as a whole simply because we don't have an official orthodoxy. It is true that I think if you were to ask, like do a survey of most of our monks and you ask, you know, what philosophy do you belong to or does your tradition fall under? Probably the majority will say Advaita Vedanta. Mm. But then interestingly, if on the survey, you then go on to ask, well, what are the core doctrines of Advaita Vedanta? I bet a lot of them will say things like, oh, well, Brahman and Shakti are inseparable, like fire and its power to burn. Mm. And this world is a manifestation of Shakti. Like, I don't think they're going to toe the Shankaran line on that. It's I think what I often find in our tradition, but also outside of our tradition in many cases, Shankara enjoys tremendous prestige. He is extremely prestigious intellectually, culturally, mm-hmm. spiritually, socially. Yep. The RSS has happily pounced on him and uses him as one of their main, you know, figure as they do with Swamiji, Swami Vivekananda himself. Mm-hmm. So he's pulled in many different directions. Okay, mm-hmm. because he's so prestigious, it's like if you align yourself with Shankara, you're part of the cool kids club. Mm-hmm. You know that popular yeah. group in high school that everybody wants to be part of. You know. Mm-hmm. And so I see what I see happening is that a lot of people say we follow Shankara, but then if you ask them, oh, what exactly are your views? They're going to start giving views, which they don't align with what Shankara says in his commentaries, mm-hmm. you know, oh yes, Shankara wrote great devotional hymns. Therefore he was a great bhakta as well. Mm-hmm. And so they start doing that kind of thing. And they push Shankara in the direction of bhakti, devotionalism, and even realism. They say that no, Shankara didn't actually deny that this world is real. All he said is that the world has dependent existence on Brahman. Every school of Vedanta believes that the world has dependent existence on Brahman. That doesn't distinguish Shankara's school from the other schools of Vedanta. What distinguishes his school from the others is that he actually says the world of names and forms is like an illusory snake superimposed upon the real rope, and that Brahman alone is real. Everything else is ultimately an illusion. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's also partly what's happening is that even though maybe many of our monks will say, yes, we belong to Shankara school, if you ask them for details on how they understand Shankara school, it'll come remarkably close to Ramakrishna's Vijnanavedanta rather than to Shankara's own school.
Hmm. Thank you. Thank you for the clarification. As we are wrapping up, I'm thinking one section which you conclude your article, Swamiji, where you speak about the danger of hierarchical views in any tradition is that it may foster an attitude of superiority, like superiority complex or condescension toward followers of other traditions. I totally agree with that. In any tradition, that can happen. Even, of course, you may even become proud of having the most. If you have, I mean, I'm not saying, and I'm not talking to you, of course, but someone may embrace Vijnana Vedanta, say, we have the most broad tradition of everyone else.
Right. And you can, yeah. So that can become a source of ego and pride as well.
Yeah. It can. Everything can happen everywhere. So, but yeah, I agree with your point. And you also mentioned each sect magnifies its own view. And I agree, in various scriptures, there is debate, and there is also in many traditions an attempt to show the superiority of one's own creed in comparison to others. We have these hierographies where the main character of the hierography is generally depicted as defeating in debate every other member of every other tradition, which I personally do not necessarily take as literally in some of our hierographies, but just as a, I wouldn't say literary device, but a way of in which things were conveyed at the time to make a point and to make the spotlight center around the superhero of the story, if you want to use the term, right? But yeah, to be honest, I relate to that, and though I may not feel that as uncomfortable with those sections, I took them as relative, as an aspect that is not substantial to our tradition. So I wanted to mention that important point because I agree that sometimes, and I've seen that in my tradition, just to offer a humbling, constructive criticism, as I know it may be everywhere else, but I'm concentrating in my own school. Sometimes there can be superiority complex that can be what I call racism, which is to be racist in the context of rasa. I'm subscribed to the higher rasa, you aren't even in a lower rasa, sometimes you witness such petty conflict using the higher theology to engage in very childish types of interaction, which is very unbecoming. So but at the same time, I will like to just make it clear for everyone, for me to begin with, that in our particular tradition that I come from, which is connected to Bhaktivinoda Thakur, especially a figure like Bhaktivinoda Thakur has been very much non-sectarian and open to other traditions. Just to introduce that idea, I recall one section from his Chaitanya Shikshamrita where he says, even if you go to a mosque or even if you go to a church or to a temple of one or other tradition, you should understand how these different personalities are worshiping the same person in a different way that we cannot fully understand, but we should witness the way they worship in a way that is nourishing to our own faith. Not only saying, okay, I will tolerate that, but I will appreciate the diversity of their practice or worship in a way that nourishes mine. So it's not that I can only be nourished by samskar from my own sampradayas. Just to make that point, and one of our main books in our tradition, which is the first one written from Sri Chaitanya's time, is Brihad Bhagavatamrita by Sanatana Goswami. And there he depicts the journey of Gopa Kumar, which of course converges in Golok Vrindavan as a friend of Krishna. But in the way of that, of course, we could see that as a hierarchical thing. He's meeting other devotees and their mood of devotion, and eventually he continues his journey to reach the highest abode. But I personally take it differently. I take it that he meets all these devotees, that he's not rejecting them. He's spending some time in each one of these abodes with each of these people. He's receiving some scars from them, from their particular mood, from their particular initiative. He's appreciating that, and but he has a call that is calling him somewhere else. For me, that's a very non-sectarian depiction of the journey. And that's the very first book of our Gaudiya Sampradaya, if we consider Gaudiya Sampradaya starting from Sri Chaitanya. So for me, that sets a very interesting parameter to, what we are about, which, again, I acknowledge that sometimes we don't have that much presence in how we engage with these topics.
It would be wonderful. You know, one thing that I asked Ravi Gupta this question, and he never got back to me on it, but I would love to see serious academic work done on Gaudiya Vaishnava
views on religious diversity. I haven't come across any proper articles discussing Gaudiya Vaishnava views on religion. So I would love for you to do that, or somebody like that. Because that's very interesting. That's news to me. It would be wonderful if you could critically engage my article and then other things and kind of defend a more liberal understanding of Gaudiya Vaishnavism. Because mine is focused on certain Gaudiya Vaishnava figures like Vishwanatha. And what you're suggesting seems to be suggesting is that there are other figures within Gaudiya Vaishnavism who can be interpreted in a less sectarian way, maybe. And that would be very exciting to see that kind of work done. Thank you so much. And I wanted to maybe add one thing in regard to your previous question about my own tradition. Which is that since my work has been published, the book on Ramakrishna was published in 2018 and the book on Vivekananda in 2022, and now I'm giving a lot of talks that are available on YouTube. A lot of our monks watch these talks, and many monks are coming out of the woodworks to come to me privately, usually privately, and telling me how much they appreciate the work I'm doing and how much they agree with it. And they'll say things like, I've always in my heart of hearts believed what you're saying, but I don't have that philosophical and theological background to defend that kind of interpretation. And so a lot of the monks in our tradition who support Vijnana Vedanta are actually not the ones who are the most visible in a way. But they're there. And as I said, it's important to keep in mind that it's very difficult to make generalizations that way. And especially if there are certain public figures in our order who are very prominent, people might assume that their views represent the views of the order as a whole. But I think that would be inaccurate.
Thank you. Thank you for that clarification. And thank you also for an invitation, engaging me in Seva in terms of inviting me to write something. I will bear that in mind, consider that, and also think about some things that may have been already written that I may share with you.
That'd be wonderful.
Just to conclude, I would like to say, from my particular perspective as a Gaudiya Vaishnava, again, just for me recalling our main philosophical school is Veda Ved, which for me is advocating a middle path of monism and pluralism, identity, difference, unity, and diversity. And for us, exclusive emphasis on one, for example, a bit leads to a denial of the world as an illusion and so on, but exclusive emphasis on the other bit difference bifurcates reality into two and creates an unbridgeable gulf between God and the world and us. So I like always to think in terms of healthy relationships also, where there's oneness and individuality, right? Too much oneness becomes codependence. Too much separateness becomes alienation, isolation.
That's a nice way of thinking about it.
So it's another way of trying to balance that. As you mentioned, Ramakrishna will use the term Brahman and Shakti, like fire of the power to burn and so on. At the end of the day, I agree with you very deeply on many things. We may have our difference, of course, with like every other single individual, but I think we touched upon very interesting points. And I'd like to conclude with one verse from Chaitanya Charitamrita. I'd like to hear a few thoughts from you, and we conclude, which it's a very interesting one. And there the author, Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami, he says, actually, every devotee or every practitioner, whatever the path, may not be even a devotee, but will think his realization or connection with the divine is the best. And then he concludes saying, and everyone is correct. So again, that's for me a very non-sectarian claim, inviting like, okay, from the subjective tongue of each one tasting a particular experience or relation, we'll say, okay, this is the best for me. No, not this is the best for each one of you, and you have to submit to my cup of tea.
Is that from the Chaitanya Charitamrita or from where?
That's Chaitanya Charitamrita,
So could you send me the original Bengali there? That would be wonderful. I'd really appreciate that. Thank you so much. Thank you. That's wonderful. I wasn't aware of that. Yeah, thank you.
So, what are your thoughts on that?
Do you know the Bangla, the original Bangla?
I don't have the Bangla with me here, right? Yeah.
I'm a stickler about the original language, so I'd want to hear what the original.
I totally agree.
If the translation is accurate, that's a wonderful thing, and it comes very close to Ramakrishna. And I want to know the original Bengali there, and then we can take the discussion further. But that's a wonderful sentiment.
No problem, Swamiji. So, any concluding thoughts or words you would like to leave our readers with, Swamiji?
No, it's been a pleasure, and it's wonderful to meet monks. I don't think it's a coincidence, by divine dispensation, that I met I told you an ISKCON Swami a few weeks ago in Rishikesh, who was very broad-minded and liberal, and now I'm meeting you and other liberal fellow traveler on the spiritual path. And so I'm very grateful for the whole conversation. And thank you so much for inviting me.
Okay. Thanks so much for accepting the invitation.